Our next speaker is Andrew Feinstein, who is a former ANC politician, which is why I was hoping that it would, could connect with you directly, more directly through that. He's a researcher and activist as well, and unfortunately is facing his own difficulties right now. So Andrew, please, if I could give you the floor. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Can you all hear me okay? Great. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation to be a part of this absolutely crucial event. And I'd like to send my personal solidarity to all of those who have faced the sort of experience that Natalie was speaking about, that we've heard about from each of you who are going to speak. And as the chair was saying, let's not forget that all of those who struggled against apartheid, who led the liberation movement against apartheid in South Africa, were described as terrorists. Most infamously, my former boss, Nelson Mandela. Margaret Thatcher did not only describe him as a terrorist and a communist, but also suggested privately to the apartheid regime that they should organize his killing in prison, as it was too dangerous to keep him alive because he was becoming a symbol of everything that they stood against. In other words, actual democracy, actual freedom, actual liberation. So I know it is little solace, but it is worth reminding ourselves that what you are suffering is what many other incredibly courageous, committed people have suffered throughout the ages. We should also not forget that Margaret Thatcher, after advising the South African apartheid state to somehow organize Mandela's death, and there was a wonderful anecdote that Mandela told of after his release, when he came to Britain, he spoke at the Great Hall in Westminster, long before he was our country's president. And Mrs. Thatcher, who had retired, was there and sort of hobbled up to him on her Zimmer frame. And Mandela gave her a big smile and said to her, "You must be surprised to see me here." And she looked confused. And he said, "Well, after all, you advised them to murder me." And for once in her life, she was speechless. But we shouldn't forget that she described as her greatest political achievement Tony Blair. Because she had effectively turned the Labour Party into a neoliberal warmongering party, and Tony Blair into a war profiteer, who has made, in my very conservative calculation, in excess of £110 million personally from the companies who profited from the invasion of Iraq and from British arms companies like BAE Systems. And for my sins, which are clearly many, I live in the constituency of the bastard son of Tony Blair, Keir Starmer. Now, for those of us who've been subject to this appalling human being for almost 10 years as our Member of Parliament, we know from personal experience that his every instinct is anti-democratic and authoritarian. And of course, this started before he became an active politician. In his time as the Director of Public Prosecutions at the Crown Prosecution Service, he never once allowed the prosecution of an agent of the British state, be it police personnel who were involved in the killing of protesters or British military personnel involved in the murder of innocents in various parts of the world. It is therefore no surprise to us that as soon as he came to power in Britain, something he's been planning for decades, one of the first things he would do is ensure that anti-terror legislation is utilized against everything that could challenge his political project. And what is his political project? It is a project to enrich and empower the billionaires who have funded his political rise and funded his political party and his corporate sponsors. Let us not forget that at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool, one of the biggest sponsors of events at that conference was none other than BAE Systems. Now, that project has at its core permanent austerity and forever wars. And the two are incredibly closely related. For in the first budget of this appalling administration, we saw a £3 billion increase in the defense budget and the signing of a blank check for whatever the Ukraine requires, in the Prime Minister's words, while at the same time, the scrapping of the winter fuel allowance, which is going to cost thousands of British lives, a refusal to scrap the two-child benefit cap, and further austerity on public transport, the health system, education. And the symbol of this political project is that Britain today is home to more billionaires than at any time in this country's history, while more families are requiring food banks to feed themselves than at any time since the end of the Second World War. The madness of the moment in which we find ourselves is that war is peace. Escalation is de-escalation. Lifelong racists label anti-racists as racist and get away with it. And of course, we have a genocide, as Natalie said, being live streamed every single day that is being committed in our names with our tax pounds. And it is not just that our government is protecting and defending the state of Israel and its genocidal actions. It's even worse than that. By arming this genocide, this country is profiting from it. Our defense companies who make the weapons that Israel is using, our political parties, and our individual politicians who, like Tony Blair and his Labour Party, profited massively from the so-called war on terror. We should also bear in mind that it is this corrupt global arms trade, accounting for 40% of all corruption in all global trade, that oils the wheels of our political systems in the West. But the reality is that today, in the ultimate madness, our putrid, corrupt, mendacious, mediocre government tells us that opposing genocide is now a terrorist offense. Well, let me tell my local MP that arming a genocide, that profiting a genocide, that protecting the genocidaires is, in my opinion, a terrorist offense, a real terrorist offense to stand side by side with Benjamin Netanyahu and his terrorist state. So what do we do in conclusion? We have to continue to write, to speak ever louder. And more than ever before, we have to stand together. The vast, vast majority of us in this country who are disgusted and appalled by what we see on our screens every day and by our government's role in it. We have to stand together and we have to make those who are not with us understand that an attack on any one of you, on any one of us, is an attack on all of us. But finally, we have to remind ourselves, just as South Africa was freed from over 340 years of racist oligarchy, so too will Palestine be free.
Thank you so much, Andrew. That was so perfect. And it really sets the tone for so much of what we want to take from this event today, this notion of the moment that we're in, who we're up against. It's something that is much larger than, you know, we sometimes give credit for. There are so many interests at play, many of them corporate interests. But ultimately, what we are building solidarity around is the Palestinian people, their right to self-determination, and their right to just exist right now, because we are in the middle of a genocide and we have to keep on reminding ourselves of that. Somebody who has been consistently reminding us of the role that Israel has been playing, that the Zionist state has been playing, is our next speaker, Tony Greenstein, who is the first Jewish person to be expelled from the Labour Party. He is the co-founder of what he describes as the useless PSC. Has been arrested twice, last December under the Terrorism Act for support of a proscribed organization, but you know, no charges after nearly a year. So, Tony, could I please invite you up? Thank you.
Right, thank you, Asim, for that introduction. I was arrested on December the 20th last year, at 7 o'clock in the morning, by about a dozen police officers from the Southeast Anti-Terror Squad. And I was told I was being arrested for a single tweet that I had posted a month before. I was asked by a Zionist, or told by a Zionist, to say, I support Hamas. And I said, no, that is not enough. And I said, I support this Palestinian resistance, including Hamas. And as anyone knows, a nation or a people under occupation have an international law right to mount resistance, and that, of course, included October the 7th. Britain is in a military alliance with Israel and is bound to the hip with the United States. And everything the police are doing is in furtherance of that military alliance. It has nothing at all to do with compliance with the law. Their interpretation of the law is, to say the least, twisted and distorted. But when we come to the question of genocide, we have a law which is quite clear, the International Criminal Court Act of 2001, which makes participation in or aiding or being ancillary to a genocide a criminal offence. But of course, the police have shown absolutely no interest in implementing that law, because if they did, they would have to feel the collar of Keir Starmer and his associates. And Keir Starmer has been consistent in his denial that there is a genocide taking place in Palestine. Indeed, he's encouraged that genocide by saying that Israel has every right to withhold food, water, medicine, fuel, and so on. And Starmer came to power in the Labour Party, promising to root out anti-Semitism. Well, we know what that was about. But if you deny genocide when it's taking place in Palestine before our very eyes, and there's no need to give examples here today of that, the destruction of universities, hospitals, the shooting of children and those who try to rescue them, etc., then Starmer is absolutely no different from those who deny the Nazi Holocaust. Starmer is a Holocaust denier. And we've seen the trashing of international law in the process, as the police see their job as harassing and intimidating Palestine solidarity activists, and not just Palestine Action, but really anyone who is involved in the Palestine solidarity movement. And they've done this using an obscure clause, section 12(1)(a) of the Terrorism Act 2000. And what does that act say? It says anyone expressing an opinion or belief that is supportive of a proscribed organization, and in doing so is reckless as to whether a person to whom the expression is directed will be encouraged to support a proscribed organization. The second leg of that is virtually impossible to define. How would you know when you express an opinion or belief what the effect will be on other people? But the act, or the clause, which was inserted by the Counterterrorism Act 2021, makes it quite clear that what it's criminalizing is an expression of opinion or belief. In other words, it has absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. And it goes on to say that is supportive of a proscribed organization. In other words, what you say about, for example, Hamas or Hezbollah may indeed be true, but if it's supportive of them, then you are still guilty of a criminal offense. In other words, expressing a truth is in itself criminal. And I just want to take a quick look at the definition of terrorism, because that is the basis on which organizations are proscribed. And it says in section 1B, the use or threat is designed to influence the government. Well, Hamas has no government. Israel is in the illegal occupation of the Gaza Strip, and the International Court of Justice has just ruled to that effect. There is no legitimate government. So how can they be a terrorist organization? And that is really the nonsense that we are facing. And if people have to think twice before they even speak as to whether they may encourage others to support an organization, what we're seeing really is the use of the anti-terrorism laws to suppress free speech. And that is not surprising. Repression abroad also has consequences at home. And I want to say that we have to build as broad of an alliance as possible in defense of really ancient democratic liberties like freedom of speech, freedom of association, because those rights are part of British law. We have adopted the European Convention of Human Rights. And I also have to say that it's a great pity that the bastions of liberal England, whether it's The Guardian or Liberty, the old National Council for Civil Liberties, have run a mile from even mentioning what is happening today. I invited Liberty to provide a speaker for this seminar, this talk, not once, but three times, but they haven't even bothered to respond. So we have a job ahead of us, but I do believe that we can win public opinion, and that if necessary, we will be able to take our cases before a judge and jury and win out there, because it's clear that liberal England has jackknifed into the authoritarian right that Starmer represents so adequately. So thank you very much. And I wish everyone good success.
Thank you so much, Tony, and so much solidarity for you. You mentioned this point about repression and the far-reaching consequences of repression. We're seeing that a lot, especially in the space of journalism. Now, you would think that at a time where journalists, especially when journalists are not permitted to enter into Gaza to report on what's taking place there, that any form of journalism that seeks to provide the truth of what is happening should be welcomed. In fact, you know, some might say that in a genocide, it's actually incumbent upon states to facilitate that level of journalism to take place. But rather, what we see instead is every single mainstream outlet, Guardian included, playing a role in inhibiting the discourse around what is actually taking place in Gaza right now. But we do have journalists who are speaking about this. And the next two speakers that I want to bring on, first Sarah Wilkinson and then Asa Winstanley, have been doing their best to cover what is taking place. So Sarah is an activist for Palestine since the first Intifada. So that's quite some while now, 50 years. She's a member of Palestine Action, been using her online presence and journalism to cover the genocide. So Sarah, I know you have been through a lot, including having your home raided. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you've been experiencing, please?
Yeah, I think probably most people have heard the story, but so I'll condense it down as much as I can. Sort of very similar to Natalie, it's sort of 10 past seven, there's a knock on the door. And the minute I opened it, we've got 16 balaclavaed huge men in the house with no identification. There's no way to authenticate if they are who they say they are. They just say they're anti-terror squad. They had a warrant but refused to show it. They were quite violent. They pushed my son up against the wall and then frog marched me up the stairs, didn't allow me to get dressed, didn't allow me to put my shoes on, handcuffed me so tightly that it cut my wrists, didn't allow me to take any medication for my Crohn's, and then threw me into a van, which then promptly, in the back of the van, I realized not being able to get ID or authenticate that these were police, that this was an execution. We drove the wrong way, about an hour's drive towards a different county. Now, I knew where we were going or where we were supposed to be going. So the fact that we were driving into the woods, if you like, I think was done to scare me, was done deliberately. These are local officers, if you like. I don't actually know what to call them. So they know the route. They had a sat nav. There was no excuse for going the wrong way, but they went the wrong way by about an hour's worth of driving. So yes, there was an hour of thinking, okay, I'm going to die at this point. But while I was in custody, which was about 12 to 14 hours, same as Natalie, they absolutely ransacked the house, desecrated my mother's ashes, knelt in them, scattered them everywhere, stole and looted about £400 in money. They took my passport, but didn't list it. So part of my bail conditions were that I surrender my passport in 5 days, which I couldn't surrender because they'd taken it, but denied that they had it. So this created another issue. But, you know, I hadn't been able to get dressed. I got no shoes. I got no meds. So I had no food. I had nothing to drink for the whole time that I was in custody, which is, you know, you're dehydrating and you can't sleep, obviously, because you're very wired and very rattled. But the house was absolutely ransacked. And it took seven people and about 5 days to piece by piece put the house back together again. And it was only then that we realized that bank cards were missing, keys were missing. I have a disabled key for the disabled toilets that's missing. My Crohn's card's missing. My medication was missing. Books autographed by the authors are missing. They've seemed to maliciously taken books that were signed, pictures from the wall. And I can't claim any of these things back because none of them are listed. So all of this stuff is gone. All of these precious items, I can't ask for back ever because they haven't taken them as far as their evidence is concerned. So that was the hideous experience. And I had seven bail conditions, one of which was that I couldn't use a phone. And the problem is with living in an area like this, you can't survive here without a phone. My family live miles away. In fact, everyone lives miles away. I've got no access to fire engines or ambulance. I couldn't use my TV because it's a smart TV. You're very, very isolated in a rural area without any telephone. And I also couldn't borrow a telephone. I couldn't use an electronic device. They've taken about £7,000 worth of equipment, including the chargers for the lights on the stairs. Now, I just need to say at this point, right, they're here because they want to find evidence that I support a proscribed organization. So they're here because they want to find out things about Palestine. So what do the stairlights, of which there are 50, because I have five floors, what are the stairlights, what do they have to do with Palestine? Why take all of the charger cables so that I can't light up the stairs for the grandkids so that they can go up and down without falling? So that was, you know, one of those items that they took, one of many, which have no relation to Palestine whatsoever. It was purely done to ransack and terrorize, which brings me to the next point that everybody else has made quite clear, is that they are saying they are combating terror, but they are using terror tactics. They're terrorizing us as civilians or citizens or journalists to counterterrorism. They're actually using terror tactics. These are terror tactics. And to scare somebody into thinking they're going to be executed, that's another terror tactic. So I'm now going to hand myself in on the 29th of November. I find out that I'm going to be arrested again on the 29th. I've got to go through the whole process again because they now have decided that they may have or may not have found something. I probably can't talk about it that much, but I have to hand myself in. They can't be bothered to come and arrest me because it's so many miles. So I've got to go there to hand myself in, to be arrested, to be interrogated all over again. So it's another 12 hours of sitting in custody without any meds, but at least I'll be dressed. But I did do a bit of research. And, you know, what I found is that, in, for instance, in a year, there's about 238,000 burglaries that take place in a year across the country. In the north of England, anything above Birmingham, basically, they consider the north, right all the way up to the borders of Scotland. The police in an entire year have not solved one burglary. In an entire year, from October to October, not one burglary. In the south of England, which is anything below the Midlands, through London, Exeter, all the way down into Cornwall, they have only solved 13% of all overall crime. That's, I think, the lowest since about the 18th century, or 19th century, I do beg your pardon. So here you can see now that the police are no longer policing. What they're doing is sitting behind desks, eating digestive biscuits and drinking tea and trolling through Twitter, finding things that we might have said or might not have said, listening to all the Twitter spaces so that we might have accidentally said something we shouldn't, going through all of our tweets, but they're not actually policing crime. Now, I did another bit of research. There's been about 20 people I asked who'd rung 999. Only 18 of them, 18 of them, the police didn't turn up between 5 weeks. So on the making of the 99 call, it took the police 5 weeks to reach 18 people out of 20 to respond to the call. So here we again, the police are not actually responding to crime, to actual crime. One of them was quite a violent crime where the young lady, she rang 999 before the crime was committed and they sent her a message. She was hiding in the dark, hoping her attacker would not find her. And they sent her a message which lit up her phone that said, sorry, you've been a victim of crime. And therefore the attack took place because they found her. And then they turned up 5 weeks later and the mother opened the door and said, what's the point of you turning up now? And they said, yes, there's no point. Her injuries are healed. There's nothing to investigate. We're not even going to give you a crime reference number. Now, there was a physical attack that the police have actively said, we're not taking this any further because we've turned up too late. And so this is kind of where we're at now. It is purely at the behest of the Israeli regime is to target, silence, gag, scare, frighten, and make sure that journalists no longer say anything, no longer report anything, activists no longer write anything on a placard and go out and protest, because people holding up signs have been arrested as well. People have been taking down Palestinian flags. So I tried to do a documentary with a colleague of mine to tell them the law about being able to fly Palestinian flags, that it was legal. Palestinian flags have come down out of the windows because people are terrified to fly them. This is again, it's a form of terrorism. It's frightening and scaring people into not being able to report on one of the most hideous genocides in history. And it's hideous, and I say the most, because it's live streamed. It's coming into our phones every day. We haven't got to wait 5 years for a documentary or somebody to write a book. The reason why it's one of the worst genocides is because we have the evidence now. We have it today. We have it every morning. We see it every day. So there isn't any excuse. We can't say we didn't know about it until it was too late. So that's what makes it one of the worst genocides. And yet now, as Andrew Feinstein so rightly said, it is an act of terrorism to object to terrorism being committed against the Palestinian people, an act of terrorism to oppose mass murder. It's an act of terrorism to shout that the Palestinians deserve freedom and self-determination. It's an act of terrorism to support a resistance which is entirely legal, and even armed struggle is entirely legal. So now all of these things are an act of terrorism, but responding to a 999 attack is not worth the police's while. And this is where we've got to. And I worry with the term incessantness kind of for me means that, which the operation was called, is that the police are going to be doing it over and over again, but each arrest, each raid is very different. It's getting slightly worse. We've now got windows and doors being smashed. And, you know, what's going to happen with the next home raids is this sort of arbitrary, well, we can get away with that because nobody dares complain because they don't get anywhere. So now we can smash a few more things up. We can loot a little bit more money. We can take gold and jewelry and get away with it. And we can be really racist at the same time and also get away with that. And so, yeah, I'm concerned as to where this is going to go, how many more raids are going to happen. I think possibly hundreds, because there's so many people have said things on Twitter. So many people have held placards up supporting the resistance. Are all these people going to be arrested one after another after another? And is speaking up for Palestine going to become so difficult that in the end we lose a huge percentage of supporters because they don't dare to speak? And this is a time where we really need to speak out.